Parsha Balak is certainly unusual in its own way. The whole events surrounding his visit to Bnei Yisrael, the curses he wanted to level, the blessings he ended up giving, certainly a lot to talk about. And from the beginning of the Parsha, we see that the Psukim require a good deal of Iyun. And let's begin by raising a number of questions on the opening Psukim of the Parsha, some of which we have discussed in previous years, but of course each Mefarish has his unique approach and his comments and insights. The first thing that's interesting to note about the beginning of Balak, and the Parsha is called for Balak, is that he's introduced by name immediately. Pasuk Beis, the Parsha begins Pasuk Beis, that's something of a miscalculation for those that set the chapters and verses. The verses are not Jewish in origin, as we know, that is to say, the division of chapters. He's referred initially as Balak, and apparently, I guess that's all you need to know about Balak, is that his name is Balak, and his father was called Zippor, and that's that. But then we have the fears, and he sees, and they send to Moab, and Moab sends to Midian, and they're all afraid. And at the end of the third Pasuk, once all of that has been voiced, the end of Pasuk Dalet, we're informed, U'Balak ben Zippor, Melech leMoav ba'eis hahi. Balak was the king of Moab at that time. Firstly, we note, of course, the implication is at that time he was the king of Moab, not before. That needs to be addressed. But first and foremost, why is it that the Torah waits to tell us who he is? I mean, this is his business card. This is his CV, Balak ben Zippor, the king of Moab. The Pasuk should have said, Bayar Balak ben Zippor, Melech Moab, etc., etc. But rather, we find out about Balak in installments. And that's a matter of great interest to the Mefarshim. Secondly, we note, although we would perhaps have described the events as Balak saw what happened and he was afraid, if we look at the Psukim, we'll see that whereas the first Pasuk describes what Balak saw, the second Pasuk describes Moab being afraid. Pasuk Bey says, Vayar Balak ben Zippor. Pasuk Gimel says, Vayagar Moab bipnei ha'am. So that's interesting because, as far as we know, and Balak is the king, and the king and the people are the same, but the Pasuk has shifted. Why is it not consistent? And moreover, in Pasuk Dalet, we see further, Vayome Moab al-Zikne Midian. It's Moab that speaks to Midian. So if we would summarize in terms of the shifting as to who we're talking about of the subjects, the first Pasuk describes Balak, but the following two Psukim describe Moab. What is behind that? And the final question, at least for us to deal with at this stage, or to raise, is how are the Jewish people themselves referred to? Once again, the opening Pasuk says, Bayar Balak ben Zippor, Es kol asher asa Yisrael la'emori. So who does he see? Yisrael. But the very next Pasuk says, Vayaga Moav mipnei ha'am ma'od ki ravu. Now who is the Am? And the Am is Am Yisrael, presumably. But once again, there's been a shift in the phraseology. We've moved from Yisrael to the Am, even though, as far as we're concerned, they're one and the same. So there's a great deal of fluctuation in terms of who's doing the seeing, who's doing the fearing, who do they see, and who sends to Midian, and what's it all about? So these questions, among others, are addressed by the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh, and we'll take a look through his eyes at the beginning of the Parsha. And the Yesod, it comes out from the questions themselves, but the basic idea is that in the beginning of the Parsha, at least initially, Balak, the person, and Moab, the people, do not actually feel the same way. They do not relate to recent events in the same manner at all. And in order to understand why not, we need to be aware of one piece of background. And that is, as we will find out later in Chumash Devarim, the Jewish people are under injunction not to wage war against Moab. It's a very interesting consideration that's given to Moab because of Lot and etc. and so forth. But they're told not to wage war against Moab. Now, if that's so, and parenthetically we would say Moab must be aware of this, otherwise it's not a factor for them. They didn't learn Parshas Devarim. But if this is a known idea, the Jewish people aren't exactly gearing up for war for them the way they are with the other nations. So the two questions that need to be raised, even if that information is known, is number one, okay, injunctions is one thing, instructions is one thing. Can the Jewish people be relied upon to follow those instructions? It's all well and good that there is, or the plan is that they should leave Moab alone. When it comes to different nations, they don't always follow the plans vis-a-vis each other. And the situation is made just a little bit more complicated because here we are saying that the Jewish people, they shouldn't really touch Moab and they shouldn't take anything from Moab. It happens to be, from a certain point of view, the Jewish people have already taken land that belonged to Moab. How so? In the end of Parshas Chukas, which describes some of the wars that happened there, we find that B'nai Yisrael came into possession of territories that originally belonged to Moab. It happened in a kind of a two-stage process. Moab originally was at war with the Amori, and the Amori were stronger, and they actually conquered territory from Moab. Now, Amori then waged war with B'nai Yisrael. So when Yisrael took their territories, some of those territories were those that originally belonged to Moab. What they would refer to in Hilchos Shabbos as a klisheni. So first they went from Moab to Amori, from Amori to Yisrael. But Moab looks upon this situation with some alarm, because as far as they're concerned, there's cause for concern. Officially, the Jewish people aren't meant to take anything of theirs, but seemingly they already have. And therefore, what is the response to all of this? What are the conclusions to be drawn? Well, in pure terms, and initially, Balak is the only one who sees things, so to speak, correctly. In pure terms, the question as to whether the Jewish people can be relied upon to follow the instruction to leave Moab alone really depends as to who is making the decisions for the Jewish people. As long as it is those who are should be in charge or in charge, those of higher moral level, well then they should be expected to follow the rules. It's only really if, and sometimes this happens, those of the lower echelons begin to call the shots and they decide to wage war without really asking their superiors, so then there could be a problem because the lower people can't always be relied upon to follow the rules. So that's the first question. Can the Jewish people be reined in by their leaders as they approach Moab? But the second point, which actually is discussed by the Gemara, is that the territories that were taken from Moab aren't really at all an infraction of the instruction not to take territories from Moab. And the reason why is because, as we said, these were not territories taken directly from Yisrael to Moab. Rather, originally they were taken from Moab by the Amori. Subsequently, and now they belong to the Amori, so when the Amori wages war with B'nai Yisrael, and then Yisrael are successful and take their territories, they're taking Amori land. Although historically, originally they belonged to Moab, but practically they don't. In the words of the Gemara, Amon and Moab, Taharu B'sichon, they became purified, they became sterilized, those lands. They lost their designation of lands of Moab as they went through Sichon, who represented Amori in taking them. Of course, that depends who you ask. If you ask the Moabi, they have a very long memory. As far as they're concerned, this is Moab land, always was, always will be, and if Yisrael take it, they're taking Moab land. But the truth of the matter is, these lands had become changed, their designation having been taken from Amori. And all of this, as the Al-Sheikh, is alluded to or encapsulated within the precision of the phraseology of the first pasuk, which states, "Vayar Balak ben Tzippor." What did Balak see? And only Balak saw it in this way. What he saw was Eskol Asher Asa Yisrael Lo Emori. And there are 2 points here. Point number one is Yisrael, as we know, always refers to the higher echelons. That would be in contrast with other terms that we will meet presently. And the first thing Balak saw, and he saw it himself personally, actually, because he was originally Emori himself, so he saw the way the campaign was waged against the Emori. And that is Kol Asher Asa Yisrael Lo Emori. It's the higher echelons, those that should be in charge, were in charge. And no one did anything that was in contravention of their instructions, which is point number one. Therefore, as we said, if Yisrael are in charge, Moab doesn't really have anything to fear. And secondly, says Al-Sheikh, the Pasuk says that Balak saw what Yisrael did to the Emori, as if to say he only saw a conflict between, because that's what it was, purely between Yisrael and the Emori. Everything they did against the Emori, not anything against Moab. The lands that originally belonged to Moab are currently belong to the Emori, and it's against them Yisrael waged its campaign. And therefore, for these two reasons, Balak, and if he was actually the only one in play, and if anyone actually listened to him, there wouldn't have been a Parshas Balak. Because rightly so, he doesn't see that Moab really has anything to fear. The irony is, he was not the only one who saw things, and not everyone saw things his way. Because the second Pasuk, Pasuk Gimel, tells us how Moab saw things. And Moab are the people, Moab at large. And they didn't have the insight, and they didn't have the perspective that Balak had. And thus the Pasuk says, Vayagar Moav mipnei ha'am, O kiravhu. They're afraid of the Am. And who is the Am? As opposed to Yisrael mentioned in the first Pasuk, the Am are those of a lower level. As far as Moav is concerned, the Am could get out of hand at any time. They could overrule anyone else's or override anyone else's, those of Yisrael, and nonetheless attack Moav. This is perhaps Moab, considering what would happen if Moab was the ones who were about to move on. And their feelings with regards to Yisrael are not those of fear, but actually mentioned in the second half of the Pasuk, Vayakotz Moab mipnei bnei Yisrael. Vayakotz, they had only feelings of revulsion or disgust with regards to bnei Yisrael, not of fear, they just didn't like them. So what a combination. The Am, who are actually probably a bit more like them, they're afraid of them. And that's point number one. And the Yisrael, who they're not afraid of, but they do have these feelings of revulsion, and therefore put those two together, and they send a message of alarm to Midian. And it's Moab that sends this message to Midian, not Balak, because as far as Balak is concerned, there's nothing to worry about. But he wasn't consulted. Dialogue has already been initiated without him between Moab and Midian. They sound the alarm. They're going to take everything. So it's an interesting situation because it's really the Am that moved before their king. So now the question is, well, what does Balak do now? And the answer, of course, is, well, at this stage, he has to get involved because the country is already involved. Moab has already made this initiative and Balak is their king. So he can't stay on the sidelines. He would not have initiated it. But since it's already been done, he now needs to preside over it. And that's why Pasuk Dalet now gives us this information. Ubalak ben Sipor Melech Lamav Ba'esahi. He's the king of Moab at that time. Not before, but he is now. And therefore, he cannot reasonably or practically stay inactive any longer once the alarm has been sounded by Moab. Interestingly, once Balak does get involved, he actually takes up the tune of Moab, even though it's not his tune, because otherwise you can't really justify trying to attack Bnei Yisrael. And therefore he says in Pasuk, Hey, Vayishlach Malachim Bilam ben Be'or. So if we keep track of who's talking to whom, Moab sounded the alarm to Midian. No one really had any ideas what to do. They just said they were in trouble. Balak is the one who sends a message to Bilam. And what he says is, Vayishlach malachim and Bilam ben Be'or Pesora, Asher al hanharet b'nei Amalek karlo, Lemor. What does Balak say to Bilam? Hine am yatsa mimitzrayim. So the first thing he says, actually, he changes his tune. He focuses, like his people do, not only on Yisrael, or not on Yisrael, but rather on the Am. The Am is out, and the Am is capable of anything, which is what Moab thinks. And secondly, says Balak, they covered the land. Now, interestingly, the word mimuli, although it's easy to translate if you hear it, because the word mimuli comes from the word mul, which is opposite, and therefore yoshev mimuli means they are dwelling opposite me. But Rashi notes that there's another meaning here, because if you look at the word mimuli, you will see that it's missing a vav. And without a vav, it actually relates to another word. As Rashi says, hu yoshev mimuli, chaser ksiv. It's written deficient without a vav, meaning krovim heim lahachriseini. Mimuli is no longer about position, it's about intention. They are now looking to cut me down. They're looking to wipe me out. What's the word mimuli got to do with that? Kemo ki amilam. It's related to the word which we say in Hallel, ki amilam. So we say sabuni gam sabuni, v'shem Hashem, ki amilam. And amilam means, right, my enemies surround me, in the name of Hashem, I'll cut them down. Amilam, that's what it means. It's one of the words in Hallel which people are less prone to know exactly what it means. With all the singing, sometimes these things can get lost anyway. But the word amilam, and therefore Rashi says, yoshev mimuli, they're looking to destroy me. But again, Balak doesn't believe that. He sees Yisrael are in charge, and they've only attacked the Amori. However, he needs almost to catch up, in a sense, with his people, and become as alarmed as they are. And this he does in the fullness of time, and he really takes over the initiative to have some type of countermeasure against Bnei Yisrael. And in fact, I saw a fascinating discussion in this regard that relates to Balak. As we know, Bnei Yisrael and Moab never really had much to do with each other. No one ever really went from one to the other, with one, of course, famous exception, and that is Rus HaMoabiyah. And it began with, of course, Elimelech and his family, and they married Rus and Orpah, but Rus came back to the Jewish people. She must have been the first Moabite convert in history, because most people in Moab aren't really that interested in becoming Jewish. We see how interested they are in the Jewish people. They're interested in destroying them, and that kind of remains. So there was never really much interplay between them. But Rus made the transition over. And moreover, this is evidence in the fact that no one really knew whether she was eligible to marry into the Jewish people, because you have to know halacha very well to know whether that's her. Because in terms of your average rabbi, the questions that he will come up during the course of his tenure will be selling chametz and the like, and they're not going to be whether a Moabite can become a woman from Moab can become a convert. It happens to be that the halacha is Moavi below Moavis. Almost no one knew that. The good news is Boaz knew it. He was the head of the Sanhedrin, and therefore he knows these things, and he's the one that married her. But it was touch and go for a while until it became established and people were convinced. And in fact, according to Rashi, based on Chazal, that's why the original Goel, who has the outstanding, memorable name of Ploni Almoni, didn't want to marry her, because he didn't know the halacha, and he thought he had halachic objections to marrying Rus. He didn't know. He didn't want to take a chance, and he didn't want to be misunderstood in his shul. So he gave it a pass, and Boaz married her. What's very interesting is it's clear that Rus was permissible for her to convert and marry into the Jewish people because she is a woman, Moavi v'lo Moavis. But she is from Moab. But there's just one question. Who is she from? It happens to be that Rus is a direct descendant from Balak. And that is actually the subject of a very interesting discussion in the Gemara. The Gemara must be at least half a dozen places throughout Shas discusses or states the famous maxim, La'olam yasug adam b'torah v'mitzvos afilu shelo lishma. A person should always involve in Torah and mitzvos, even with ulterior motives. It's okay as long as they're not dangerous or poisonous motives, just ulterior motives. Shemitov shelo lishma v'lishma. There's a lot of value in shelo lishma. It's a good beginning. And the Gemara in Sotah, Daf Mem Beis, which is one of the places where this is mentioned, brings an example of the value of doing a mitzvah, even shelo lishma. It's the most incredible example. And that is Balak. Because Balak built Mizbechos and brought Korbanos. As we see in Parshas Balak, on three occasions, he built three mizbechos, offered seven of each, 3 times 14, 42, and look, says the Gemara, look who came from him, Rus HaMoavia. and that's great, that's a good result. Ima Shel Malchus. So as examples of mitzvahs shelo lishma, that's really one for the books. I mean, seemingly this is more than shelo lishma. He's offering these korbanos to facilitate Bilam being able to effectively curse the Jewish people. That's a very benevolent categorization, a mitzvah shelo lishma. So be it. But the point is, we're in an interesting situation. Because we now know, aside from the discussion aside, we now know that Rus is actually descended from Balak. Well, Balak was the king of Moab, but he wasn't from Moab. He's an Emori. Balak ben Zippor, Melech leMoab, Ve'isahi. But he's not a natural born Moavi. And therefore, the Mefarshim asked the question, the Maharit, in the Chidushin to Maseches Kiddushin, Daf Samach Vav, raises the question. Now we know that Rus isn't really even not only is she not a Moavi, she's not even a Moavia, because she's descended from Balak, and Balak is not a Moavi. So why do we need to take recourse to the fact that because she was a woman, she's not subject to the ban of Moab? She's not even from Moab. It's an interesting shaila. And the answer, there's many answers to this question, but the Maharit's own answer is really fascinating, and that is, it's true. Balak was not a natural Moavi. He was a self-made Moavi. And what does that mean? If you look in the Pasuk in Kiseitse, which presents the prohibition of Le'avo Amoni Umoavi Bekal Hashem, it gives two reasons as to why that is. And one of them is Vasher Sachar Alecha as Bilam Ben Ba'or Meram Naharim Nekal Alecha, because he hired and commissioned Bilam to come and curse you. Well, as much as that was done on behalf of Moab, the one who actually did it was Balak. And therefore, if that's the reason to ban Moab, the people whom he represented, all the more so it should ban the individual called Balak who actually did it. And therefore, he became, in this respect, an honorary, or we would say a dishonorary Moavi. And the same is true for his descendants. And that is why the only reason his descendant Rus was able to marry to the Jewish people is because she was a woman, and the ban of Moavi is and not Moabis. That is a fascinating comment of the Maharit there in Maseches Kiddushin. So the parasha has begun, and Bilam has been asked. And as we know, and Bilam is a complicated person because he knows that he cannot come to curse the Jewish people if he doesn't receive permission from HaKadosh Baruch. So he has to ask, and he does. And not surprisingly, the answer is no. As Hashem says at the end of Rishon in Perikav Beis, Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayom Elokim Abilam, Lo Telechim Ahem. You can't go. Lo Toras Ha'am. You can't curse them, even if you don't go. Ki Baruch Hu, they're blessed people. Well, that's that. For most people, that would be the end of the story. But for Bilam, it's just the beginning, because he doesn't like the answer of no. And therefore he nudges and sees what will happen. And so, Balak sends another delegation. Bilam asks again. And in Pasuk Kaf, we find a different response. Vayavo Elokim al Bilam Laila, Vayom Elo. Hashem comes to Bilam and says, Im lekro lecha bo hanashim, if they've come to call you, kum lechitam, you can go, with one proviso, of course. But you can only do that which I tell you to do. You can only say that which I tell you to say. Okay. So the answer seemingly has been modified. And as we say, So it's been mollified slightly. And although it was originally no, but now the answer is yes. I mean, under certain circumstances that you have to say what I tell you to say. So Bilam, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Vayakam Bilam Baboker, Vayechavo Shesasono, Vayelechem Sari Moab. He gets up, saddles his donkey, and off he goes with the nobles of Moab. And then Pasuk Kaf Bei says, Vayichar Af Elokim Ki Holechu. Hashem was angry, and many Meforshim, beginning with Rishonim, asked the same question. And that is, seemingly, so to speak, Hashem doesn't have the right to be angry with him for going, because he allowed him to go. So if you stay by no, and he went anyway, so that's a contravention of instructions. But you said he can go, under certain circumstances, but you said he can go, so he's going. So then how then does Hashem get angry? I mean, the simple answer one could say is that even though he gave him permission, Bilam should have known that he doesn't want him to go, and therefore Hashem was angry that he went anyway. But nonetheless, if we follow the letter of Hashem's word, he did really give him permission to go. So how then can he be angry? So I saw a fascinating answer to this question in the name of someone called Rabbi Shlomo Ishtaruk, who was one of the early Acharonim. And he has a very interesting approach here. To remind ourselves, we say that Hashem told Bilam, you can go, but you can only say what I tell you to say. And now, so the question is, when do we imagine or expect that Bilam is to find out what it is that Hashem wants him to say? So I think we're used to the fact that, or perhaps we understand, Hashem says you can go, but stay tuned, because when the time comes, I will tell you what to say, and it's on that understanding that you can go. But Rav Shlomo Eshtaruk says that the expectation is that Hashem will tell Bilam now what it is that he's going to say. And the reason why he's going to tell him now is because Bilam may decide that he doesn't want to go. In other words, Hashem says, you can go, but you can only say what I'm going to tell you to say. So wait to hear what it is I tell you to say, and then make up your mind. However, Bilam didn't do that. He bolted. And when the pasuk says in Kaf Aleph, "Vayakam Bilam Baboki," he got up extra early and he left as quickly as he could. He saddled his own donkey, which he never does. Eino lufi chavodo. Vechavoshes asono. It's reminiscent, as the Chazal say, of Avram Avinu. What Avram Avinu was so zealous to do a mitzvah, Bilam is zealous to get moving already, because he doesn't want to hear what the details are. He's heard yes, even though the full answer is yes, but Bilam stops at the yes. You had him at yes. And he wants to move already and going with Sarim Moav. That's not fair. That is not following the terms of the understanding, because Hashem says you can go, but there will be certain things I want you to say. Do you want to hear about them? No. As far as Bilam is concerned, that's small print. And he doesn't read small print. He reads the headlines, and the headlines say, I can go. And moreover, he's looking to move away and keep on the move so that Hashem isn't almost even able to communicate with him. And that's why, says Rav Shlomo Eshtaruk, the pasuk continues and says that Hashem sent him a malach. As if to say, Bilam has close communications with Hashem in terms of finding out any more particulars about his mission. So if he doesn't want to hear from Hashem, so Hashem sends him someone that he can't move around in order just to keep the conversation going. As if to say, Bilam had he put his phone on silent, so Hashem sent him a text message. He's not interested in hearing from Hashem. He sends him a malach, and somehow he's something that he cannot ignore in order to be fully aware as to what's at stake. So that's Rav Shlomo Eshtaruk's explanation as to why it was that Hashem gave him permission, but was yet angry that he went, because he didn't really fulfill the terms of hearing out what would be involved before he went. But I'd like to present now quite a different answer to this question. And it's based on the writings of Rav Gedalia Shor Zatzal and the Sefer Or Gedaliahu, a very special Sefer. And he begins by quoting a very mystifying statement of the Arizal. The kinds, but as we'll see, for again, the pasuk says, Bilam went, Vayichar af Elokim ki holechu. Now we translate those words as Hashem, God became angry that he was going, Vayichar af Elokim ki holechu. But the Arizal says that Vayichar means he became angry. Af is anger. And if vayichar means angry, and af is anger, then vayichar af means anger became angry. Vayichar af Elokim means Hashem's anger, af Elokim, became angry at Bilam for going. The question is, what is the meaning of Hashem's anger being angry at Bilam? What's the background to that statement? So Rav Shor explained, the basis of this idea is in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about this in a couple of places in Maseches Brachos and Daf Zayin and Avodah Zarah Daf Dalet, that Bilam had a very interesting skill set, and certain things were known to him. And among the things that were known to him is, as the Gemara says, there is a moment in the day where Hashem, so to speak, gets angry. It's based on the pasuk in the Navi, I think it's in Amos, V'kel zo'em b'chol yom, za'am. Hashem gets angry every day. V'kel zo'em b'chol yom. But it's just for a moment. And Bilam knew that moment. And he wished to capitalize on it and lay his curses on the Jewish people. How do we know it's a moment? For the pasuk says in Tehillim, in Mizmashiach HaNagasabais to David, Ki rega ba'apo. Ki rega ba'apo means there's a moment of anger. And then the Gemara has an interesting discussion as to how long a moment is. As we know, that's a very flexible term. Someone can say, oh, they'll be with you in a moment and you never see them again. So how long is a rega? So the Gemara says, it's the amount of time it takes to say the word rega, which is actually not a lot, assuming, again, that you say it at a normal pace. In fact, as we have mentioned in the past, this leads Tosfos to a very interesting question. Because here we are, and Bilam seems to be banking a lot on this moment, because this is the moment, and if you say your curses, then there really could be trouble. But it's just a moment long, and a moment's not a long time. It's the amount of time it takes to say rega. And therefore, as Tosfos, well, how much can you say in a moment? How much can you say in to say rega, you know, by the time you've cleared your throat and you know, thanked your host, etc., the moment's gone. And Tosfos give two tirutzim, but a very interesting answer of Tosfos is that it all depends when you begin. If you get your foot in the door at that rega, then you have air time. You don't have to say the whole thing, you just have to know when to start. If you start at a time of anger, then you can continue, even if it takes longer. Very interesting answer. And what's fascinating is, as we move, so to speak, from the realms of Parsha and maybe from Agada or metaphysics to Halacha, there's a very interesting Shaila that's dealt with one of the Hasidic greats, or Simcha Bunim of Parshischa, with regards to the time of Tefillah. As we know, Mincha, for example, everyone has until Shkia, or whenever one has until, let's say Shkia, for argument's sake. Okay, so let us say that the Shmona Esrei, which is the quintessence of the tefillah, would take a person 5 minutes to say, and it's 3 minutes before Shkia. So you can start in the time, but by the time you finish, it won't be the time anymore, is the preferred option here. Of course, the preferred option is don't be in a situation like that in the first place. Okay, that's too late for that. So should one start what you can't finish in time, or perhaps it's too late, and maybe just daven two ma'aribs, as is the case. It's just not an option anymore. So Simcha Bunim says you can start. The Mogen Avraham, by the way, says don't start, but Simcha Bunim says you can start, and the reason why you can start is because as long as you started during the time of Tefillah, you can continue even if it's not Zman Tefillah anymore. And his basis for saying this is the comment of Tosfos with regards to Bilam. Because, says of Simcha Bunim, good is always outweighs evil. Midah tova merubah. Anything that's true for bad will be true for good. If Tosfos said that when it comes to cursing the Jewish people, as long as you start at the right time, you can continue even beyond that time, that will certainly be true for davening, says of Simcha Bunim. If you start within the time, you can continue. One may be inclined to perhaps put this in the category of unmanageable Hasidic statements. But it happens to be that Rav Simcha Bunim is concurred with by no less than the Aruch HaShulchan, who says exactly the same thing and brings the same proof from Tosfos. So we're not here to paskan halachas, and certainly one shouldn't think about this during the time, otherwise the whole of Zman Tefillah will go. But this is a very interesting halachic spin-off, one could say, from this Tosfos with regards to Bilam. But in any case, this is Bilam's hope. He knows when the rega is, he wants to use it, and thus he sets out. So now the shaila is, well, was he successful? And we do, did he succeed in capitalizing on this moment? Could he seize the moment? And the Gemara says, no, it didn't work, didn't help him. Why not? Because all those days that he was trying to curse the Jewish people, Hashem didn't get angry during those days. So the whole thing was off anyway. Much to Bilaam's disappointment. He knows the moment, he says what he says, nothing happened, and he's not sure why. But much to his disappointment, Hashem didn't get angry during those days. So of course, to understand the significance of Hashem not getting angry, so to speak, during those days, we really need to ask, what is the value or role in Hashem getting angry all the other days? You know, why is that considered a good thing? It's an especially interesting question because the verse which is the source for this idea, the pasuk that we quoted, V'keil zo'eim b'chol yom. Keil, aleph lamed, is the name of chesed. Chesed keil, kol hayom, Hashem, Hashem, keil rachum v'chamem. Which now is almost a contradiction because we talk about Hashem getting angry, but we say it's an act of kindness. V'keil zo'eim b'chol yom. Why or how? So Rav Gedalia Shor says that from a certain point of view, this moment of anger, it is an act of kindness because it helps people. It helps people be the way that they should. There are certain things that are damaging to a person physically and certainly spiritually. But in order to avoid them, one needs a certain sense of discipline. One needs a certain sense of boundaries. Except a sense of discipline and a sense of boundaries is really a product of a sense that one is really responsible, and life sometimes has serious parts to it. It's not complete hefkeiros. The role of that moment of anger, says Rav Shor, it's almost like an injection of din into the world. Something happens, it could be an event, it could be a feeling, whatever it is, it just takes a moment. But that moment is like a daily dose of a reminder that life is a serious business. It's not an absolute free-for-all. And that is why it helps people. It helps people keep away from things that are unhealthy for them, if they heed it, if they take note. Everyone has bechira, but this helps. Say it is an act of kindness. Chesed keil kol hayom. It's Hashem is just nudging us back from the edge where we might otherwise tend towards. And in fact, if we consult again that pasuk in Tehillim, which says that Hashem gets angry for a moment. Ki rega ba'apo, how does the pasuk continue? Rega ba'apo, chayim b'rtzono. Those words are really qualifying what the moment of anger is about. There is a moment of anger, but to what end? For what purpose? Ki rega ba'apo, chayim b'rtzono. It's out of will for life, right? Hashem wants people to stay alive. Sometimes you have to perhaps act in a way which is a little bit more abrupt or harsh to stop a person from destroying themselves. But it's life-promoting, that moment of anger. But it can be used for bad. And that's why Bilaam wants to use it to lay a curse. All things being equal, it's a positive thing. But if you capitalize on that moment, he could damage the Jewish people. And that is a real danger. And the reality of that danger is evidenced by the fact that Hashem defended the Jewish people, so to speak, by not getting angry. As if to say, had Hashem, yes, gotten angry during those days, they would have been damaged. It was a real threat. The way that Hashem evaded it or obviated it was to not get angry. But now the question is that good? Is it good that Hashem doesn't get angry for a few days? The answer, says Rav Shor, is it's not good at all. Because once we appreciate the role and the life-promoting and the life-preserving role of that moment of anger, it keeps people with a sense of boundary and a sense of a certain achrayus. There's only so many days that the world can go without that moment of anger, which means without those feelings being reinforced, and they could lose their sense of boundary. And that's not a good situation. And the kind of the tragic irony of Parshas Balak really comes at the end of the parsha. Because just before he leaves, just before Bilaam leaves, he gives Balak a piece of advice. As the Gemara elaborates, and you see it in the Psukim, that the God of the Jewish people, he hates promiscuity. If you tempt them in that area, you'll do a lot of damage. And that's exactly what happened. The daughters of Moab, they came out, the Jewish people were tempted, and Balaam ended up inflicting more damage with that piece of advice than he did with any of his curses, as far as we know. His curses were largely ineffectual, but his advice, it fell 24,000 among the Jewish people. Except, should we ask, I mean, just to consider the situation or survey it, how could it be the Jewish people, they seem to have just capitulated rapidly? Whatever happened to their sense of discipline or sense of right and wrong and all of that, the answer is this was the fallout from those days of Hashem not getting angry. Those were days where a sense of discipline loosened and loosened more and more, which meant that finally the climate was ripe, and that's why Balaam never gave this piece of advice earlier on, because there's reason to conclude that this would never have worked earlier on. They would have been tempted and they would have said no, and that was that. However, the climate had changed, and it was because of Balaam, in response to Balaam, there's been no anger. Days without anger can lead to tohu vavohu. And that pretty much describes or characterizes the Jewish people at the end of the parsha. And that's why Balaam says, atah hineh olech la'ami, now I'm going, meaning now the climate is right to give you this piece of advice. So this is a very interesting view or understanding of the entire parsha. But to come back to the statement of the Arizal, that is what he meant when he said, or part of what he meant when he said that Hashem doesn't want Balaam to go, because he doesn't want to get into this whole thing. He doesn't want to have to suspend his anger, which could lead the Jewish people to other. And Balaam asked again, and Hashem let him go, but Hashem's anger was angry that he left, because now the Jewish people could be susceptible to other types of damage, self-inflicted, in fact, as indeed became the case. So these are some comments with regards to, starting with the beginning, but really leading on to Balaam's whole visit. And from here, let us consider a statement about Balaam that is made by Chazal. And this is found in the Pirkei Avos, in the fifth parak, where it compares, well, the Talmidim of Balaam to the Talmidim of Avram Avinu. And that itself is a discussion as to why it does not compare Balaam and Avram themselves. But in any event, the Mishnah says, this is in Perikei Pirkei Avos, Kol mi sheyesh biyado meyesh biyo shlosh advarim halalu, a person has the following three attributes, whom he tamidu shel Avram Avinu. He is a student, a follower of Avram. Ushlosh advarim acherim, whom he tamidu shel Balaam harasha, which is very interesting, because we look upon Balaam as an isolated individual, and he's just there seemingly for our entertainment. But along comes the Mishnah and says he has Talmidim. And if they're the wrong type of people, they could be Jews. But he could have his own following. What does it depend on? Ayin Tova, Beruach Nemucha, V'Nefesh Shefala. The three positive attributes are Ayin Tova, a benevolent outlook, Ruach Nemucha, a lowly spirit in the sense of humility, and Nefesh Shefala, one whose drives are contained and is in control of them, not out of control. He's Tamidav Shel Avram Avinu. But Ayin Ra'a, a negative outlook, Ruach Gavoa, a high spirit, a haughty spirit, arrogance, Benefesh Rechava, and one whose drives are out of control, Tamidav Shel Balaam Harasha. And it's very interesting that in the end, the difference between these two sets of Talmidim comes down to midos, comes down to characteristics, to character traits. Ruach Nemucha, if we just leave the Ayin Tova and Ra'a, defer them to the end. But Ruach Nemucha, humility of Avram, is something that we see as we really read the parshas of Avram. We see how forbearing he is, even with those that are possibly even taking advantage of him. The way that when Lot is misbehaving, Avram is conciliatory with him, and they part on good terms. He doesn't just castigate him. And even as Avimelech, who took Sarah and was punished for it, Avram davens for him, the pasuk says. He davens for him. You see how he talks to Ephron and Bnei Ches as he needs to bury Sarah, even in his time of grief, ever gracious, ever forbearing. That's the Ruach Nemucha of Avram. In fact, we mentioned in the past a wonderful comment of the Ben Ish Chaim, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, in his Chiddush Yagodas Ben Yehoyada, in Maseches Bava Kama and Daf Lamed. There, the Gemara talks about how to become a chassid, how to become a pious person. There are certain things that it doesn't mention, but it does mention three things. And one of them says the Gemara, Le'ayin b'milei de'ovos. You should look into milei de'ovos if you wish to become a chassid. And most Mefarshim understand that milei de'ovos actually refers to the matters of pirkei avos. Because if you go through pirkei avos and you implement them, well, you're well on your way to being a chassid. It's full of wonderful things. But the Ben Yehoyada says, Le'ayin b'milei de'ovos means, if you want to be a chassid, look at the words of the avos. Look at how the others speak. Look at how they address other people, how they deal with them, how they're patient with them, how they don't lord over them, and gratiating. Because now, in a sense, you look through Chumash Bereishis differently. See how the others are speaking. You can speak like that, regardless of circumstance, even adverse circumstances. That's a chassid. Very interesting. And what about Nefesh Shefala? Avram is never interested in taking things from anyone. He's always giving. He doesn't need anything. But then come to Bilam. And Bilam is the opposite. He's a Baal Gaiva, Ruach Gavoa. You can see how he talks to Balak. If you watch carefully, the first delegation that was sent to him, and Hashem says no, but Bilam he's embarrassed to say that Hashem didn't let him go. So he put it down to something else. He says, what are his words? Go home. Hashem doesn't let me go with you. Rashi comments, imachem with you, as if to say, if you really want me to go, it's going to be people who are not like you. I mean, you are low-level officials. It's not really lefichvodi to go with people like you. Which is a complete falsification of, but you couldn't bring himself to say that, Hashem just doesn't let him go. So you put it down to them. You're the problem. Well, and of course, again, paying attention to his words, as he said, but even if Balak would give me his whole house full of gold and silver, it's very interesting that he says that. That's what he wants. If only he could. He'd like a house full of gold and silver. He's got one already. Wants another one. Wants a summer house with gold and silver. So these are the middos, as we see. I mean, that's aside from his physical drives, which are discussed by Chazal with reference to the whole episode with the donkey and the angel and all of that. And what about Ayin Tova and Ayin Ra'a? What does that mean? A good eye, a bad eye, positive outlook, negative outlook. So this matter is discussed by a very special Perush on Pirkei Avos, which is known as Yein HaLevonon. The Yein HaLevonon was written by someone called Rabbi Naftali Hertz Weisel, who himself is a rather complicated person, and there's a lot to talk about him. He's somewhat controversial. Different people relate to him in different ways. But the Perush Yein HaLevonon is a very special Perush. And he explains as follows. Ayin Tova, benevolent outlook, as opposed to a negative outlook, really goes in two directions. There is Ayin Tova in terms of someone who's receiving from you, Ayin Tova or Ra'a in terms of someone who's receiving from you, and Ayin Tova or Ra'a in terms of someone who's giving to you. Now, what does that mean? The idea of Ayin Ra'a with someone receiving from you is actually mentioned in the Torah, because when the Torah tells you not to be stingy in giving tzedakah, so it says, V'ra'a einecha v'achicha ha'avyon. Right, your brother, he's destitute, he's poor, don't look upon him negatively. And what does it mean to look upon him negatively? In other words, at the end of the day, are you giving him tzedakah or no? But the way we give tzedakah is a function of how we look at things. If we look upon him as being undeserving, or he's not, that type of vision, so you're not going to give him. And the Torah says, don't look at him that way. And this is true on an ongoing basis. The people that we can give to, we're inclined to give to people about whom we have a benevolent outlook. They deserve it, and we should help them. That's Ayin Tova, and we help them. They don't deserve it, and therefore we shouldn't help them, leads to, that's an Ayin Ra'a. That's in terms of the receiver. But there is also, says the Yein HaLevonon, a concept of Ayin Tova and Ra'ah in terms of someone giving something to me. Well, what does that mean? If he's giving, he's giving. What's positive and negative about that? But still, one can look in a positive way, one is being given, or in a negative way. What is a positive way? To ascribe positive motives to the giver. He's giving something to me. He's offering something to me. Why? Does he have my interest at heart? Ayin Tova says, presumably, why not? It's very nice. I'm very grateful. Very appreciative. Ayin Ra'ah is always looking for the angle. Ayin Ra'ah is always looking for the agenda. He's giving something. What does he want from me? Why is he giving it from me? How does this help him? What will he want from me in the future? Now I owe him a favor. This probably isn't for my own good anyway. That's an Ayin Ra'ah. All you're doing is receiving, and still you have a negative outcome. And interestingly, in this respect, says Yehin Halevanon, you also see Bilam and Avram divided between Ayin Tova and Ayin Ra. Not only in terms of how they give. Avram gives unreservedly. He davens for everyone. He gives to everyone. But Ayin Tova in terms of the people he gives to. But what about Ayin Tova in terms of what he receives? And specifically in terms of what he receives from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How do we see the midah of Ayin Tova there? It's clear to Avram that whatever Hashem tells him to do is in his best interest. And that is why he rises to the occasion, even though it doesn't always appear that way. That couldn't happen unless he had an Ayin Tova. And it really comes to the climatic point when Hashem tells him to kill Yitzchak, which defies logic on every level. But all Avram knows is that that's what Hashem has told him to do. The ability to set aside his own vision of that and follow Hashem's instructions is only because of Ayin Tova. So to say Avram says, I don't understand it, it really goes against everything that I know to be true, but if Hashem tells me to do it, it must be the right thing to do. And thus he goes. And he goes with alacrity, difficult as it was. It's fueled by Ayin Tova in terms of what he's receiving. He's receiving an instruction, it's for my good. Bilam is the opposite, and it explains so much about Bilam. How else can we understand, on the one hand, he knows that he can't curse the Jewish people without permission, and permission is denied, which means the answer is no. But Bilam doesn't like that answer. But what's not to like? If Hashem tells you no, then isn't that the right answer? No, it's not the right answer for Bilam, because Bilam has Ayin Ra'ah. And Ayin Ra'ah means that there's always lurking in your consciousness the notion that that's not the best answer for me. Hashem isn't really giving me the best answer for me. He's giving me the best answer for him, but not for me. He's holding me back. If I can, I'll get him to change his mind, and then it will be good for me. That whole mindset is one of Ayin Ra'ah. Interesting to note, this idea of Ayin Tova, Ayin Ra'ah, it lies at the heart of the first Aveira, of the first Chet, the Chet of Eitz Hadas. Because that's how the Nachash, which means that it does have a certain pull to it. The Nachash says to Chava, and by extension then to Adam, she says, Hashem knows, if you eat from the tree, Hashem knows that he doesn't want you to eat from the tree, because then you'll be like him. He doesn't want you to be like him. That means that it's in his interest that he told you not to eat, but it's not in your interest. So maybe you should reconsider. Which means that the first chet was fueled by a vision. And the vision is, I've heard Hashem's instructions. I'm not sure they are in my best interest. Amazingly, but important to add here, that was Chava's mindset, that maybe the instructions Hashem gave me aren't the best for me. Within a few moments, she became a victim of that mindset. Because the first thing Adam said when confronted by Hashem is, well, my wife gave it to me. The wife that you gave to me, she gave it to me. And Rashi says, what he meant to say is, well, why'd you give me a wife like that? Part of the very same vision. Because really, Adam should have thought, well, if Hashem gave me the wife, that's the one for me. She's the best one for me. But Adam himself is thinking, well, that's the wife Hashem gave me, but if he really had my interest at heart, he would have given me a different one, because look what she did. So she was the first one to subscribe to it, and then she became an object of this mindset. And the rest is history. So that is Ayin Tova and Ra'ah in terms of what we receive. And it's a different type of outlook in terms of our relationship with Torah. That's why we say the recovery from the Chet of Adam Arishon, the first bout of recovery, was Matan Torah, as the Gemara says. The venom of the snake left us at Matan Torah. Somehow we rose to the occasion, and what did we say? Naaseh v'nishma. Naaseh v'nishma is backed by a benevolent outlook, because what you're saying is, I don't even know what's in the Torah yet, but the answer is yes, because whatever it is, I'm sure it's good for me. That's Ayin Tova. That's a recovery from the Chet Etz Hadas. The Yena Levonon goes further, again, in a fascinating way, because one of the Tanoim, the rabbis in Pirkei Avos, lays specific emphasis on Ayin Tova, and that is Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. He's one of the famous five Tamidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Perek Beis of Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his Tamidim, Tzu'u Uru'u, go out and see, investigate. What do you think is the best middah that a person should take? The primary middah. Not the only one, but the primary one. And each one came back with their middah, and Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus came back, Ayin Tova. So what's very interesting, the next Mishnah says, Hu haya monesh vacha. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he enumerated, listed the positive qualities of those Tamidim. And what did he say about Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus? Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Bor sud she'enu ma'abe tipa. He is like a lined pit, doesn't miss a drop, nothing goes missing. That means whatever he's learned, he doesn't forget. Now that doesn't mean he had a photographic memory, because that's not a sheva, that's just a fact of life. Bor sud means that he is responsible for that. But how is he responsible for that? Says the Yena Levonon, because that's the very same Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus who lays so much emphasis on Ayin Tova. Ayin Tova means you have a benevolent outlook, not only in who you give to, but who gives to you. If you have Ayin Tova in what you receive, then if you receive words of Torah, you'll never forget them. You'll never lose a drop. Because if the Rebbe says, and he's teaching me, and everything he teaches me is for my ultimate benefit, that outlook is what helps you preserve everything. Because shame to forget it. This is taking me forward. So these are the wonderful comments of the Yena Levonon with regards to those three middos, and specifically the mid of Ayin Tova. It really is literally an eye-opener to see how Ayin Tova also relates to the people giving to us, not just people receiving from us. And to conclude, and how does the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos conclude? Ma bein Tamidov shel Avraham Avinu, Tamidov shel Bilam HaRasha. What's the difference between these two Tamidim? Which is very interesting, because if we would stop the Mishnah here, we would say, shall we count the ways? They're different in basically every single respect. But the Mishnah mentions one thing. Tamidov shel Avraham Avinu, Ochlin b'olam hazeh, v'nochlin olam haba. They eat in this world, Havat Tamidov Bilam HaRasha, Yorshin Gehinim v'yordin le'be'er Shachas. So this seems to be the difference in terms of the direction that they're headed, which we could have worked that out more or less. Good middos will take you to a good place, bad middos to a bad place. What's the chiddush of the Mishnah? It says the Yena Levonon, the chiddush is that there is a myth here being busted. Namely, the notion sometimes is that if you're a good person, you do the right thing, so you don't always enjoy life in this world so much, but you have a good life in the next world waiting for you. And the opposite is true for people that don't really follow the rules. They do what they want, so they enjoy life in this world, not so much in the next world. But that's a myth. And the reason why is because the only person that's truly happy, as we say, is the Ashir Samech Bechelko, a person who's possessed with these middos, Ayin Ra'ah, Ruach Gavoah, he's haughty, so no one will ever respect him enough, and he'll never have enough, and his life is just misery from the minute he wakes up to the minute he goes to sleep. As opposed to someone who has Nefesh Shefala, Ruach Demucha, he appreciates everything, he's happy with everything. Look at the two of them. And lo and behold, contrary to advertised expectations, the Talmud of Avraham Avinu is enjoying life in this world, and the Talmud of Bilam HaRasha's life is misery, just like Bilam is miserable the whole time. And that's why the Mishnah says, you know the difference between them? They're different in every respect. Talmid of Avraham Avinu, Ochlim ba'olam hazeh. They enjoy olam hazeh. And because they're able to enjoy it. And Ochlim ba'olam hazeh. They get both. And Bilam gets neither. Yordan le'gehinim, Yoshim Gehinnim, Yodin Abe Shachas. Those two terms, says the Yena Levonim, Yodin Gehinnim, even when they're alive, Yodin Gehinnim. They never know who's going to be maligning them and who's going to double cross them and who didn't respect them enough, etc. And at the end of the day, they Yodin Abe Shachas anyway. So this is the open secret of the fifth parak of Pirkei Avos, and certainly among the many lessons one well worth of our attention and reflection and consideration as we take a look at this parsha. We'll leave it over there for this evening.